This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we get a crash course about the true nature of tariffs and the potential economic impact of another war under the Trump administration.
Economist Rick Wolf returns to the show to speak on these topics and just how volatile the war against Iran is becoming.
We'll then get another perspective on the war against Iran from Marjorie Cohn.
Professor Emerita Marjorie Cohn will also give us updates on the naval blockade in Cuba and the subsequent results of the fuel shortages there.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Trump did not deliver the traditional State of the Union address to the American people and Congress. Instead, for nearly 2 hours, he hosted what amounted to be a MAGA campaign rally. Trump's approval rating is under 40% and sinking, especially now with the war that he started against Iran. The two uppermost concerns of the American people are their increasing economic difficulties and their opposition to ICE and its reign of terror in major American cities like Minneapolis, Chicago, and Los Angeles. He put both forward as huge successes. Trump has secured a budget of billions of dollars to fund ICE, which has more money going forward than in the combined budgets of all the state and local police departments in the country. And the Department of Homeland Security is either building or leasing space for huge detention camps across the country. Trump has issued National Security Presidential Memorandum No. 7, NSPM 7, which targets critical thinkers. NSPM number 7 was then supplemented by a list of laws by Attorney General Pam Bondi, where she indicates that they'll be used against these disobedient critical thinkers and activists. Joining us today is University of Massachusetts economics professor emeritus Richard Wolf. He last appeared on Law and Disorder 7 months ago. Professor Wolf contributed to our book, From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism, American Style, published by Ohr Books, and is active with the program Democracy at Work. The New York Times says that Professor Wolf is, quote, probably America's leading Marxist economist. Professor Richard Wolf, a hearty welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Glad to be here.
Rick, let's begin by talking about the state of the American economy, taking in the fact that the American-Israeli regime began what looks like a catastrophic and probably a long war against Iran just last week. What's your take on how it's going to affect the American economy?
Well, at this point, my best guess would be that it'll be bad for the American economy, and the longer it lasts, the more bad it will be. We are in the middle, people should remember, of a war in Ukraine, which has used American weapons more than any other country's weapons, maybe perhaps the Russia's, but certainly an enormous amount of our weapon supply has been used up. We are making noises, or at least our government is, bombing Nigeria, snatching the head of Venezuela, threatening Cuba, and I could go on, but, you know, fighting any war, if it's your only war, is hard. Fighting multiple wars is usually harder. And so you'd have to be kind of desperate, and that's probably a good word to keep in mind in our conversation today, to undertake yet another war when you're already involved in multiple wars. And that would be a hard thing to do economically, militarily, and of course also politically, since the man in charge who makes the decisions ran a campaign promising no more war. It's particularly difficult for all of that. As to the status of our economy, it is extremely fragile. Let me give you the basics. We have a severe problem of economic inequality. huge number of economists who don't agree on many other things will agree, as by the way the polls of the American people agree, that the inequality in the United States today, by which people mean mostly inequality of wealth and income, but to that you could add the inequality of real political power, is unhealthy and unsustainable. If that's the case, you're looking at an economy which not only has that problem, but is doing exactly nothing to solve it. Now, to be fair, Mr. Biden didn't do much to solve it, and the previous presidents neither. Economic inequality has become worse steadily over the last 70 years. It's as if the New Deal's result for the United States was the last 75 years characterized by a systematic program of rolling back the New Deal, bit by bit, legislation by legislation, money supply by money supply. That's what it has been doing. The charge to do it was led by the Republicans. It always is. They did it the most harsh and rough way. The Democrats, however, proved to be really no different. They just did less of it. They didn't do it quite as quickly, and they didn't do it quite as harshly. And that meant that the working class opted for the Democrats until the failure of the Democrats to do hardly anything to slow it down meant that many people in the working class decided to abandon the Democratic Party one way or another. And that put it in the doghouse and made it possible for someone like Trump to become a president. But nothing Mr. Trump has done is going to solve the problem. I'll give you just one or two examples. One of the rationales that he ran his campaigns on was that the United States has been losing manufacturing. That's true. We have been for half a century, if not more. Okay. What is he going to do about it? His answer was the tariffs. And even before the Supreme Court ruled them unconstitutional, the tariffs were a failure. People should understand that we've had about a year now of tariffs, more or less. And over that period of time, the number of manufacturing jobs in the United States dropped by 75,000. I mean, that is a stunning number. It's not that the tariffs failed to give us a big increase in manufacturing jobs. And it's not even that it gave us no increase. It actually worsened the situation in terms of manufacturing jobs and all that that implies, which is why it became a big issue for both Democrats and Republicans. Neither in his first term, nor in his second term, neither in his taxes, nor in his tariffs, did Mr. Trump do anything to solve either the inequality problem or the manufacturing. And I could go on, but it is a very, very fragile, poorly functioning economy that is now going to be burdened. And I'm talking about real burdens from an additional war, which the country, frankly, cannot afford.
Well, Rick Wolf, speaking of tariffs, Trump just doesn't want to give up on it, does he? He says tariffs that he initiated without congressional approval as required are nevertheless going to generate so much money that they could possibly replace the income tax. Who pays these tariffs? And do you believe they could possibly replace the income tax?
No, in fact, I make a prediction. I don't believe in prediction, but I'm going to make a prediction that future textbooks of economics will have a small chapter in them devoted to the lunacy of the tariff program of Donald Trump as a kind of case study students should read because it'll give them a clear idea of what not to do. So let me answer your question. A tariff is a tax. Nobody should have any doubt about it. It's just the name of a particular tax. And what's particular about it? The tax is applied to any good or service brought into the United States for sale, but produced outside. So if you drink French wine, then you're bringing a product produced in France over here to be sold and consumed. But the payer of the tax is the American company that brings everything from abroad in. You know, all the companies that stock your local liquor store where you might buy that French wine. The importer pays the tax. Now, the importer may not want to be stuck with a tax. That's typical. And may decide that the way to handle the situation is to jack up the retail price that you and I pay by whatever the tariff is, so that in the end we pay it rather than the importer. But it's either an American company importing or an American consumer retail buying who picks up the cost. And recent research has proven exactly that. The Kiel Institute, which is a globally recognized German research outfit, did the math and came to the conclusion, get ready, 96% of the tariffs imposed by Mr. Trump so far have been paid for, you guessed it, by Americans. The clever thing Mr. Trump did, and clever is something he actually deserves credit for. The clever thing was by calling it a tariff, he obscured that it was a tax. And by saying the tariff is, I'm going to hit China with a tariff, I'm going to stick it to the Canadians, he gave the impression that the tariff was something paid by those foreigners. And so you Americans, to whom he had to go to get the taxes paid, he was trying to fool you doubly by not admitting it was a tax and by suggesting it was a tax that would be paid for by foreigners. And those statements are both stone cold lies. I mean, there's just no way to justify what he's doing. But it was clever if you think about it. The Republican Party has made its name in American society by being the party against taxes. It's been doing that for over a century. If there is a tax, they're in favor of obliterating it, canceling it, or lowering it. And they never propose more taxes, unless, of course, it's on the average person. And then they lie about it and say it's a tax reform or some other verbal noise. So they had this problem that the Republican Party, by endorsing Trump's tariffs, was basically breaking with its own history, a history in which it is the anti-tax party. And that tariff was a big, fat tax. Now, let's be clear. Before the tariff tax was passed, we had what Mr. Trump called the big, beautiful tax bill of early last year. That bill gave an enormous tax cut to corporations and the rich. And Mr. Trump's advisors calculated by giving a big tax cut to corporations and the rich, well, then they wouldn't complain so much when a little later you hit them with a tariff, because basically they would come out neutral since they had gotten the nice cut before they ever had to pay the tariff. Wrong. Republicans hate taxes no matter what they're called and hate them no matter what they are or when they're contextualized in this manner. Now, Mr. Trump controlled the party well enough to get the tariffs passed for a while. But when he got to the Supreme Court, the history of the Republican Party caught up with him. Three out of the six sitting conservative members of the court were good Republicans. I'm sure all six of them are. But three of them were good enough to realize that what Mr. Trump was doing was violating, undercutting, and dangerously threatening the reputation of a party that is supposedly for the common man or woman by holding back taxes. the party was going to now be stuck with the Trump history, if you like, of being a big tax maven. So they smashed him. They absolutely punched him right in the nose and took away the tariffs, which he now has to come up with verbal make-believe. Believe me, if the Supreme Court did what it did the first time around, he made the best case he could. Now he's going to stretch the logic of law, which you fellows know better than I anyway, even further to get a tariff going, and that's going to draw the Supreme Court's critical attention yet again. Now, finally, they were supposed to raise money. As you said in your introduction, the tariffs would raise so much money that we would all be better off and we wouldn't have to impose an income tax. Total crock. Don't think about it for more than 2 to 3 seconds because it's not worth your time. Let me explain. The tariffs imposed over this last year that have now been declared unconstitutional and will have to be refunded in part or toto raised, I'm going to be generous, $150 billion, maybe $170 billion. During the time that this money was raised, the president, and I'm just picking one item, indicated that the defense budget, excuse me, the war budget for this coming year will be raised from $900 billion to $1.5 trillion. And that was before declaring war on Iran, which will raise expenditures for war. Okay, that's an increase of $600 billion. The tariffs did not raise even a third of that, which means that this coming year, with or without the tariffs, we're going to have hundreds of billions of dollars of greater government borrowing than we have had in recent years, which have been record years of $1 trillion or more dollars of annual debt addition, deficits. There's no control here of the government budget. The promise to balance the budget, to get our finances back in order, which Mr. Trump said 100 times, he's just blown them to kingdom come. And let me remind you, that is before we take into account the declaration of a major new war. And finally, people should be clear. This is a different war from those the United States has fought. We've had 4 major wars in the last 70 years, Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq. In each of those wars, the United States did not win. We fought to a stalemate, dividing Korea in half, North and South, ever since. In Vietnam, our enemy was the Communist Party of North Vietnam. That's who runs that country now. They won, the U.S. lost. In Afghanistan, the enemy was the Taliban. Who runs the country of Afghanistan today? The Taliban. They won, we lost. It's hard to say who's in charge in Iraq. It's a country split up many ways with lots of fighting going on. But one thing is clear. The U.S. didn't win. Okay, not only were these 4 big, fat losses, but they were with countries that were at the time among the poorest countries on earth. These were wars of the United States, one of the richest countries on earth, with the biggest military anybody has ever seen, in wars with 4 very poor countries, and the U.S. could not win. If you're a betting man or woman, take a look at this war. Iran is a country of 90 million people, way larger than those others, much richer than those others. Much more developed industry, much more developed military, and with an immense long border with Russia, who can provide them with more missiles and howitzer shells than any other country on earth. This is a very different kettle of fish. You're not zipping in there, killing the Ayatollah, and then figuring everybody will look the other way. This is an enormously risky bet. The only country that's even riskier in this mess is Israel, because they run the risk of total obliteration. Not because others are going to come get them, because they have become the American servant in these things, and the whole world looks at them at that way. What a way to go into a future when the United States is in a decreasing capability of playing the role of an empire that it no longer can really preside over. We live in very interesting times, but they are excruciatingly painful and difficult and dangerous.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Professor Emeritus Richard Wolff on the state of the economy. Rick, there's a crisis of affordability in the USA. We all recognize this. New York City's Mayor Zohran Mamdani ran on a platform addressing this very issue. But Trump says, to the contrary, that prices are going down, especially fuel, electricity, and food. What is the real economic situation here today?
We had a serious inflation in the period of the pandemic, or more accurately, in the year or two after the worst of the pandemic had passed us. It got as high as 8 or 9%, and then it proceeded to decline. And most of the decline from the 9 or 8% to the 3 or 4% we have now was achieved, if you're going to be fair, under Mr. Biden. By the way, not because of Mr. Biden, but he was lucky. He came after the worst of it was over. The worst of it was the problem of, in a way, of Obama and in a way of Bush. But the reality is it was supposed to go down, if not to zero, then to 1, maybe 1.5%. It stopped doing that because of Trump. It stopped doing that because of what I told you before. The tariffs were a tax. They were paid by the American importing companies, but they passed a good number of them on to the general public. So our inflation didn't come down as much as the population wanted, as much as the population demanded, as much as the population voted for. And that can be put at the foot of the tariffs. And therefore, that's the fault of Mr. Trump, because he decided to use tariffs in a way no president ever did before on a scale the way Mr. Trump did. But for just those reasons, since he's trying to hold on to the tariffs, and since we are at war with Venezuela, an oil producer, and now Iran, an oil producer, and now Iran, who sits on one of the major shipping routes, the Arabian Sea, the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz that Americans are learning about now, all of these things are going to raise the price of oil and gas. Or let me correct myself. The prices of oil and gas, natural gas, have already risen. In the few days, the week barely, that this war has been going on, already the prices have gone up big, 10% or more, and they promise to do that in even greater size. So we are at the edge of what will be a resumption of rising prices, which will make the affordability conversation very acute. There's very little Mr. Trump can do, and even less that he's prepared to even try to do to cope with this. But it will take very dramatic measures. Someone like Mamdani, if, for example, he can come through with rent freezes and some of the other initiatives he's taken, then he will get the credit for really doing something about the affordability. But Mr. Trump talks about it, says a lot of things that are, I mean, I don't know how to say this politely, they are far from the truth. Prices are not coming down. They're not going to come down. If you raise the price of oil and gas, you're raising the price of everything, because everything either takes oil or gas to be made, or it takes it to be conveyed or transported to where we, in the end, use it, whether that's the oil that is delivered to heat your home or the gas that's delivered to fill the tank of your car or whatever it is. It's oil that brings your food to the supermarket, and if it costs more to pay for that oil, which it already does, you're going to see rising prices as the people, the commercial folks, don't want to pick up the cost of all of that by themselves, just like the importers didn't want to pick up the cost of the tariff. Mr. Trump is doing something that may be good for the people at the top. Yes, they've gotten their taxes reduced. Yes, the stock market has been fine. But for the mass of people, no. They're the ones that are taking it on the chin. Poor jobs, insecure jobs, jobs with declining benefits while the prices go up and the costs go up. And the signs of it are everywhere. The president has to say the opposite, because otherwise his would simply be yet another voice among the many that are saying, we are in a declining economy. And by the way, the popular polls, the Gallup poll, the others, they all show that large majorities of the American people are upset. That's why the Democrats like the slogan of affordability. But the polls show that people are disaffected from the whole structure of our government. That's why they voted for someone kind of wild like Trump in the first place. That's in part why they voted for Mamdani. He was different. A Muslim socialist in the city of New York was something few thought was possible. But the disaffection with existing politics, and for good reason, leads people to want something else. Mamdani is going to try to do it. Trump didn't even try. Trump was all theater, no substance. All bravado, promising this, promising that. The golden age is upon us. It's going to be so profitable. For the people at the top, it has been. I always want to be fair. There are not only losers here.
Well, thank you, Professor Richard Wolff. Unfortunately, we've run out of our allotted time. But before we let you go, can you tell our listeners how they can follow your work?
You can find out much more of our work. And the easiest two ways to tell you how to do that is to go to our website, democracyatwork.info. Very simple, democracyatwork.info. Or you can go to Substack. And there again, democracyatwork.substack.com. And you'll see all the work that we do, the radio and television shows, the books we publish, and the videos we produce, all accessible there.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
More than 1,000 Iranians, primarily civilians, including 180 students at a girls' elementary school in Manab, have been killed in the U.S.-Israeli war of aggression against Iran that was launched February 28th by President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. This aggression has destabilized the region and triggered Iran's legitimate exercise of self-defense. Trump claimed he attacked Iran to prevent it from developing nuclear weapons. But U.S. intelligence has found that Iran is not acquiring nuclear weapons. Before the February 28 U.S.-Israeli attack, the country of Oman had been brokering negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. The U.S. and Israel insisted that Iran stop enriching uranium, limit its ballistic missile program, and end support for its proxies, Hezbollah and the Houthis. On February 27th, Oman's foreign minister said on CBS News that the negotiations had made significant progress and a nuclear agreement was within, quote-unquote, our reach. Nevertheless, Trump maintained that diplomacy had been exhausted. The U.S. and Israel began bombing Iran the very next day. 1 month before the U.S. and Israeli attacked Iran, Trump issued an executive order aimed at tightening the U.S. noose around Cuba's neck. Trump's January 29th order preposterously declared Cuba, quote-unquote, an unusual and extraordinary threat, without providing a shred of evidence. He warned that he would impose punitive tariffs on states that deliver fuel to Cuba. Trump's intention is to suffocate the Cuban people, who rely on oil for 80% of their electricity. Oil shipments to Cuba have virtually stopped. The lack of electricity has led to widespread blackouts, impacting hospitals and essential services. Cuba's oil reserves could be totally depleted by March. With us today to discuss both the war in Iran and the U.S. naval blockade of Cuba is Marjorie Cohn, a former host on Law and Disorder. Marjorie is Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, Dean of the People's Academy of International Law, and a past president of the National Lawyers Guild. She sits on the National Advisory Board of Veterans for Peace. She is a member of the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers and serves as the U.S. representative to the Continental Advisory Council of the Association of American Jurists. Her books include Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. And she writes a regular column for Truthout, including two recent ones about Cuba and Iran, which helped inspire today's show. Marjorie Cohn, a warm, warm welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Well, thanks so much for having me back.
It's always a pleasure, Marjorie, always. Well, let's start. We're going to cover both the war in Iran and the U.S. government's warlike actions on Cuba. Let's start with Iran. Please explain the trajectory of negotiations about Iran's nuclear program leading up to February 28th, because then on February 28th, of course, the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran. Was that a legal attack, by the way? Did Iran then have the right to respond, to have self-defense? Talk to us about that.
So Trump claimed that he attacked Iran to prevent it from developing nuclear weapons, but we have to look at the negotiations preceding the February 28th attack in the context of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan or Action, sometimes called the JCPOA, that was negotiated by France, Britain, Russia, China, Germany, the U.S., and Iran during the Obama administration. Now, in this deal, the JCPOA, Iran agreed to restrict its uranium enrichment and other nuclear activities. And in return, the U.S. unfroze billions of dollars in Iranian assets to provide relief from punishing sanctions. Now, until Trump pulled the U.S. out of the deal during his first administration, the deal was working to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. Nevertheless, in 2017, Netanyahu convinced Trump to withdraw the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal. He bragged, "I asked Trump to leave the JCPOA. It was me who made him to depart from the deal." Now, had this JCPOA remained in force, then the current U.S.-Israeli aggression would almost certainly have not happened. So the U.S.'s Israeli aggression against Iran violates the United Nations Charter, which requires that all states settle their disputes peacefully and refrain from the use of nuclear force, except in two instances. One, when acting in self-defense, or two, when the Security Council authorizes it. Before February 28th, Iran had not mounted an armed attack against any country, nor did it pose an imminent threat to the U.S., Israel, or another U.N. member state, and the Security Council had not authorized the use of military force against Iran. So this aggression against Iran violates its sovereignty and territorial integrity, which is what aggression is. Aggression, by the way, was considered the supreme international crime at Nuremberg. At Nuremberg, there were four crimes that were punished, four atrocious crimes: genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and aggression. The crime of aggression was considered to be the most serious. So Article 2 sub 4 of the UN Charter says that all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the UN. Aggression is certainly inconsistent with the purposes of the UN. An act of aggression is defined as the use of armed force by a state against the sovereignty, territorial integrity, or political independence of another state or in any other manner inconsistent with the Charter. That's what the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court says to define aggression. It's consistent with a General Assembly resolution definition of aggression. And aggression includes the invasion or attack by the armed forces of a state of the territory of another state. So a so-called preemptive strike, purportedly to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons, is not legal. It violates the UN Charter and constitutes aggression. Article 51 of the Charter, which is the self-defense provision, says, "Nothing in the present Charter shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the UN until the Security Council has taken the measures necessary to maintain international peace and security." And after the U.S. and Israel mounted these armed attacks, this aggression, Iran was lawfully permitted to act in self-defense. Before the February 28th U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, the country of Oman had been brokering negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. The U.S. and Israel insisted that Iran stop enriching uranium, limit its ballistic missile program, and end support for Hezbollah and the Houthis. On February 27th, the day before the U.S. and Israeli attack on Iran, Oman's foreign minister said that the negotiations had made significant progress and Iran had agreed to more concessions than those it had agreed to in the JCPOA. The Oman foreign minister said a nuclear agreement is within our reach. Nevertheless, Trump maintained that diplomacy had been exhausted and the U.S. and Israel began bombing Iran the next day. In a videotaped announcement, Trump misleadingly said that the Iranian government has rejected every opportunity to renounce their nuclear ambitions. And citing no evidence, Trump declared the Iranian regime has built nuclear weapons. Now, this contradicted Trump's declaration in June of 2025, after his bombing of Iran's nuclear sites, that the U.S. had obliterated Iran's nuclear program. Israel erroneously stated that Iran is armed with nuclear weapons. For the past two decades, Netanyahu has claimed that Iran is on the verge of acquiring a nuclear weapon. Trump said that in order to avoid a war, Iran would have had to say, quote, those secret words, we will never have a nuclear weapon, unquote. But Iran has said that several times. And in fact, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei issued a fatwa banning nuclear weapons in 2004. The Trump administration has admitted that it has no evidence Iran is weaponizing its uranium enrichment program, or even that it has restarted enriching uranium since last June. Iran has always maintained that it enriches uranium for peaceful purposes, as permitted by the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And also, there is no evidence that Iran is developing intercontinental ballistic missiles that could hit the United States.
So, Marjorie, do the United States and Israel seek regime change in Iran? And is that legal? And please give our listeners some background on the 1953 U.S. regime change in Iran.
Yes, Michael, both Trump and Netanyahu have made it clear that they want regime change in Iran, and their killing of Ayatollah Khamenei is consistent with that goal. But forcible regime change is illegal. The UN Charter, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights all guarantee the right of peoples to self-determination. The two covenants have the same first sentence in their Article 1, and it says, "All peoples have the right of self-determination. By virtue of that right, they freely determine their political status and freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development." But as you pointed out, this is not the first time the U.S. has engaged in forcible regime change in Iran. In 1953, the CIA covertly orchestrated the overthrow of the democratically elected Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who had nationalized Iran's oil industry against British oil interests. The U.S. then installed the vicious Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, who ruled Iran with an iron fist for 25 years. In 1978, I actually went on behalf of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers to Iran as a human rights observer, and I saw horrific conditions there and evidence of torture by the Shah's people, the Sabak, the secret police. We met with political prisoners, former political prisoners who took their life in their hands to meet with us. They showed us the scars on their backs from the torture from the Shah's men. And then they told us about this horrific torture technique where they put a helmet on the head of the person and then tortured him. And the screams of that person being tortured would be magnified inside his head by virtue of this helmet. Guess who taught the Iranians that torture technique? Israel. That's what they told us. Well, 1 year later, 1 year after my mission to Iran, the chickens came home to roost because the Shah was overthrown in the 1979 Iranian Revolution, and he was replaced with the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini's theocracy. So when Khomeini died 10 years later in 1989, he was succeeded by Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who was assassinated by, I think, Israeli strikes backed up by the U.S. military on February 28th. This time, U.S. regime change in Iran was overt, not covert.
Well, Marjorie, will the U.N. Security Council take any action to stop this war? And if it won't, are there other alternatives?
The UN Security Council met on February 28th, but it did not pass a resolution about the U.S.-Israeli bombing of Iran, which is not surprising since the U.S. has a veto and it would never allow a resolution condemning its own bombing. Now, if the U.S. prevents the Security Council from carrying out its duty under the UN Charter to restore international peace and security, the General Assembly, which is the democratic body of the UN, can convene under what is called Uniting for Peace, which was a resolution passed by the General Assembly to bypass the Soviet Union's veto during the Korean War. The General Assembly under Uniting for Peace can recommend that its member states impose arms and trade embargoes on the U.S. and Israel. The General Assembly could also suspend the U.S. and Israel from its ranks, but these decisions would require a vote of two-thirds of the 193 General Assembly member states.
What about the congressional War Powers Resolution?
Well, the War Powers Resolution, which was passed in the wake of the Vietnam War when Congress did not want to be lied into going to war like LBJ did during the Vietnam War or before the Vietnam War, the War Powers Resolution allows the president to introduce U.S. armed forces into hostilities or imminent hostilities in only three instances. First, when Congress has declared war. Or second, in a national emergency created by an attack on the U.S., its territories or possessions, or its armed forces. Or three, when there's specific statutory authorization, such as an authorization for the use of military force. None of those three conditions was met before the U.S. attacked Iran. So Trump launched a major war against Iran without seeking congressional approval, and the Constitution allows only Congress to declare war. Last week, the Senate defeated a War Powers Resolution that Senators Tim Kaine, a Democrat from Virginia, and Rand Paul, a Republican from Kentucky, had co-sponsored. And that resolution would have said, Congress hereby directs the president to remove the United States armed forces from hostility within or against Iran unless explicitly authorized by a declaration of war or a specific authorization for the use of military force. A similar measure was defeated in the House. So basically, Congress surrendered its constitutional duty to President Trump.
Indeed. Well, all right, Marjorie Cohn, let's now turn our attention to the situation in Cuba. Please provide us some background, if you would, on the, 67-year-long U.S. embargo and blockade of Cuba. Also, I understand there is litigation pending before the U.S. Supreme Court about some of the expropriations of foreign property after the 1959 Cuban Revolution. Explain that to us as well, if you would.
Yes, well, for 67 years, the U.S. government has maintained a vicious and illegal embargo or blockade of Cuba. After the 1959 Cuban Revolution, the Eisenhower administration declared a partial embargo on trade with Cuba to pressure the people to overthrow their new government. The embargo was a response to a secret State Department memo that proposed, quote, a line of action which, while as adroit and inconspicuous as possible, makes the greatest inroads in denying money and supplies to Cuba to decrease monetary and real wages to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government, unquote. 2 years later, John F. Kennedy expanded the embargo, and it persists to this day. Now, in 2015, Barack Obama loosened some of its restrictions. Then, during his first term, Trump reversed Obama's progressive measures and imposed 243 onerous new sanctions, 50 of them during the COVID-19 pandemic, as part of his maximum pressure strategy against Cuba. The blockade has cost Cuba $7.5 billion in 2025. Since 1960, it has cost Cuba $170 billion. But although the blockade continues to take a toll on the Cuban people, it has been unsuccessful in causing the Cuban people to overthrow their socialist government. The imposition of this blockade without UN security approval was illegal in the first place. It constitutes unilateral coercive measures that violate Article 41 of the UN Charter, which empowers only the Security Council to impose and enforce sanctions. They also constitute collective punishment, which is outlawed by the Fourth Geneva Convention. On October 29th of last year, for the 33rd consecutive year, the General Assembly overwhelmingly adopted a resolution calling for an end to the U.S. economic, commercial, and financial embargo of Cuba. The resolution urged states to refrain from promulgating laws like the Helms-Burton Act, the territorial effects of which affect the sovereignty of other states, the legitimate interests of entities or persons under their jurisdiction, and the freedom of trade and navigation. Now, before the 1959 Cuban Revolution, U.S. companies owned or controlled 90% of Cuba's electricity generation, a large portion of its mining industry, sugarcane fields, telephone system, and several oil refineries and warehouses. After the revolution, the new Cuban government expropriated those assets and transferred them to government-owned companies. In 1996, Bill Clinton signed the Helms-Burton Act, which codified the embargo against trade with an investment in Cuba so that no president could unilaterally lift the sanctions. Title III of Helms-Burton allows U.S. citizens to bring lawsuits against U.N. and foreign entities for allegedly trafficking in property confiscated in Cuba since 1959. U.S. nationals who formerly owned commercial property expropriated by the Cuban government in 1960 were now authorized to file lawsuits in U.S. courts, including non-U.S. companies that might be trafficking in that property. But every U.S. president, beginning with Clinton, delayed the implementation of Title III by suspending its provisions in six-month increments. And Clinton put Title III on hold because it triggered immense opposition from U.S. allies whose companies operated in Cuba would become targets of litigation in U.S. courts. But in 2019, during Trump's first administration, Trump announced that he would no longer suspend operation of Title III, opening the door to federal lawsuits. And a number of those have been filed. Two of them are now pending in the Supreme Court, which heard arguments in those cases on February 23rd. One has to do with a U.S. company that owned a right to use and operate the docks at the Port of Havana before 1960, and it filed a lawsuit against four Florida-based cruise ship companies seeking hundreds of millions of dollars from the cruise lines that transported tourists to the port between 2016 and 2019, even though the Havana docks, right to use the docks, had been set to expire in 2004. The case raises the due process questions of whether Havana docks should be permitted to receive much more money than Cuba should have paid it originally. And in the second case, the issue is whether Cuban state-owned companies are immune under sovereign immunity from a lawsuit filed by ExxonMobil, which seeks more than $1 billion for the confiscation of assets owned by Standard Oil, its predecessor. Attorney Jules Lobel, a good friend of ours, used to run the Center for Constitutional Rights, active member of the Lawyers Guild, argued in the Supreme Court on behalf of the Cuban-owned companies that the court should not read in an exception where Congress did not enact one. It was hard to say from the arguments how these the members of the court will come down on these cases. We'll know by July of 2026. But one more thing I want to say is that on several occasions, Cuba has offered to negotiate compensation of the nearly 6,000 claims of U.S. parties, as it did successfully with claims from other countries. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Cuba said in a 2019 statement, "It is well known that all nationalizations of foreign property, including that of the U.S., were provided by law with a commitment to compensation, which the U.S. government refused to even discuss while it was adopted by the governments of claimants of other countries, all of which enjoyed due compensation."
Please describe the current U.S. naval blockade on Cuba. Is it legal?
Well, Trump's attempt to tighten the fuel blockade of Cuba comes on the heels of the U.S. oil blockade of Venezuela, which had supplied more than 50% of Cuba's oil. Countries that provided Cuba with oil, particularly Mexico, halted their oil shipments after January 29th. So the answer to your question is yes, the U.S. has imposed on Cuba a naval blockade, and that's considered an act of war. The Trump administration is militarily seizing oil tankers attempting to deliver fuel to Cuba. The New York Times reported on February 20th that in recent days, vessels roaming the Caribbean Sea in search of fuel for Cuba have come up empty or been intercepted by U.S. authorities. The U.S. Coast Guard intercepted a tanker full of Colombian fuel oil en route to Cuba that had gotten within 70 miles of the island. A U.S. official anonymously told the Times that the Coast Guard's interception of the tanker headed to Cuba was part of a blockade that the Trump administration has not yet announced. Now, the oil shipments to Cuba have virtually stopped. The lack of electricity has led to widespread blackouts impacting hospitals and essential services. Cuba's oil reserves could be totally depleted any day. And one more thing I should say is that this also constitutes an illegal unilateral coercive measure in violation of Article 41 of the UN Charter, as I explained before.
Well, how has the Cuban government then responded? You've mentioned the price they're paying and having no oil coming in now. But how have they responded to this oil blockade? What steps has it taken to develop any alternative energy sources?
On February 23rd, Cuba's Ministry of Transport launched a new transport system to facilitate the commute of health workers in Havana. And the government is installing charging stations with solar panels and energy storage systems.
Marjorie, what countries support Cuba in the face of the oil blockade? What are they doing?
Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum warned that Trump's threat of new tariffs would unleash humanitarian crisis of great scope in Cuba. And she said Mexico unequivocally reaffirms the principle of sovereignty and free self-determination of peoples, a fundamental pillar of our foreign policy and international law.
Well, Marjorie, sadly, we are out of time. How can our listeners follow your work?
My work is largely contained on truthout.org. If you go to the bottom of their page there under Human Rights and Global Wrongs, you'll see my column. And also they're collected along with my videos and radio shows, books, etc. on my website, marjoriecohn.com.
That's wonderful. And again, it's been so helpful to have you with us today. We thank you so much for taking the time to join us today and explaining these two crises really in the world.
My pleasure, Jim and Michael.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.